Welcome to Underworlds Underground, the only Warhammer Underworlds podcast where one of tonight's hosts is allergic to their favorite food. Please join us again as we discuss Warhammer Underworlds, our favorite competitive miniatures game. Generally, our goal with this show is going to be to help introduce new players to the game, help people learn to get better, help their communities grow. My name is Thomas, and joining me is Other Mike, or Fish Mode, author of the Spent Glory series. How's it going, Mike?
It's going pretty good. I have a St. Patrick's Day tournament on Sunday. We're recording today on the March 15th. So Sunday is St. Patrick's Day, and we're holding a green skin themed Nemesis event in my town. There's going to be a couple of new people coming out. Lots of orcs and goblins, and we'll see who's the most cunning and who's the most brutal.
Very cool. I'm excited to see what I'm sure will inevitably be very fun pictures of that. Also joining us is Bridget, a excellent player, also local to my Tucson, Arizona meta. Recently played the Starblood Stalkers at LVO. How's it going, Bridget?
So far, so good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We're going to start this episode the same we do as every episode with our Helping Hands segment. So we'll go through and do some community shoutouts. Other Mike, do you want to kick off our shoutouts?
My shoutout for this week in Helping Hands, there's a YouTube channel called Flicks Tabletop Gaming, F-L-I-K. And Flicks Tabletop Gaming does a bunch of tabletop games, but he also occasionally will put out Warhammer Underworld's video battle reports. And he plays a solo game against himself, kind of being both factions, talking you through his thoughts and stuff. It's been around for a while, but I only just learned about it recently. And he's been kind of chugging away at this and showing off, here's his cool warbands that are all beautifully painted. He plays the game and makes it accessible in a way that you can see yourself playing this game. And this, you know, the comments under each of these videos are like, oh, I love this game. I'm so glad you show it. So if you're looking for more video battle report that's in a more casual setting and a way to watch more recorded games, because there really are not a lot of people doing that right now, Flicks Tabletop Gaming is a hidden gem. And hopefully some of you get some enjoyment out of that.
Very, very cool. All right, Bridget, do you have anyone you'd like to shout out today?
Yes, a friend in our local group, Lindsay. She's just a chill member, and she's excited that we're excited.
I do really enjoy, hanging out with Lindsay anyway. We play D&D with her a lot, and that's super fun, but games with her are always very chill and very fun. For my Helping Hands shout out, I want to shout out Robin from Agents of Sigmar, actually. They posted recently on their Instagram a converted Grimwatch warband where most of the little like Gribbly models are various Robins from the Batman canon. It's a super fun kitbash, looks super cool. Additionally, scrolling through their Instagram, they have a really, really well done Storm Coven, which I'm obviously partial to, and painted in a pretty similar scheme to mine. I really enjoyed seeing those too. Agents of Sigmar does do a decent amount of Warhammer Underworlds content. It's not really their main focus, but they do produce some cool stuff for it. So definitely go check out Agents of Sigmar and specifically Robin's Instagram.
They did also do a Ultimate Getting Started in Warhammer Underworlds video that's been pretty well received. And so if you like that kind of stuff, or you have a friend who you're trying to convince to play this game and they're a YouTube type of person, then Agents of Sigmar has a recent and relevant video that you could send their way and hopefully grab a couple new players for yourself.
Awesome. So we will move now into our making a statement for this episode. We're going to spend some time talking to Bridget about the Starblood Stalkers, which are a warband that she has a ton of reps in at this point. Her Clacktroc in particular has become well known in our meta as surviving things he shouldn't. And so we thought it'd be fun to have her on to tell us about her adventures with them. So diving right into that, we'll start with our first question is a little more generic. When did you take up board games or minigaming in general? What's your history of gaming overall? And how'd you get into Underworlds more specifically?
Yeah, so board games in general, sort of as maybe a lot of people have, or maybe they don't, but board games have just always been there. Grew up playing different games, Scrabble with my grandma and with my family. But then D&D and tabletop RPGs about 10, 12 years at this point. And then mini games, this is going to be the second time, maybe third time people have heard this name, Malifaux, about 5 years ago at this point with you, Thomas, as you remember.
Yes.
Another game that at the time was being supported and awesome lore to the game. And was lots of fun. And then Underworlds came out, and that had a few starts and stops, sort of first introduced, got Megora's Fiends when that came out, but was no real support to play it. And then as you, Thomas, and another friend were trying to just get me into Sigmar in general, you guys figured you would have more luck with the fantasy side of Warhammer than with the Warhammer side of Warhammer. Was trying to decide which faction, and I landed on the Seraphon, and I'll get into more detail on why that was later, but then the Starblood Stalkers came out. So I picked that up, and then you and Aaron put together the community together a year and a half ago, thereabouts, and so been playing consistently since then.
Yeah, I've said before, I think, but this game is not the first game that I have just like manufactured a community base out of basically just forcing my friends to play it with me. And that was true of Malifaux 2, and that grew into a pretty decent sized community up until, I mean, for various reasons, and not the least of which being the pandemic, we stopped playing it locally. And then we all kind of picked back up on Underworlds together. And I appreciate that you are always willing to go on these journeys with me.
I do like how, Bridget, you were saying that Thomas thought that he would have more success with the fantasy side of Warhammer than the Warhammer side of Warhammer. Because 40K and space and guns and lasers and aliens is apparently like the whole thing now. And you're not wrong, unfortunately. That's like fantasy component totally plays second fiddle. And I wish that that wasn't the case, that they were more like evenly represented and more people were willing to give fantasy a shot. Because I feel like so many people that I know, they say, oh yeah, you know, the Space Marines are the whole thing. And they either aren't aware of or just not interested at all in fantasy when there's plenty there. And honestly, I prefer it. So either way, let's dive into our next question. So Bridget, now that we know you have started playing Warhammer Underworlds, you did Megora's Fiends, you did Starblood Stalkers, two very different warbands. What would you say your general play style is in this game? And what are your favorite warbands to play?
Yeah, so general play style has largely, since I've been playing the Skinks, a lot of hold and invade. I dabbled some for a while for one of our leagues with the Gnarl Spirit pack, just because they seemed more aggro, but also had a little bit of finesse to them in deciding whether to have them be beasts or inspired. And then, yeah, those have been the warbands I've had the most reps on, and I'm shopping around to see which other ones will be the next thing I do. So, yeah.
Okay, so rolling into our next question then, what do you enjoy most about Underworlds?
So, lots of great aspects. We'll start with the first one because it has something in common with Dungeons and Dragons, which play a lot of. Dice are great.
Yeah, they are.
It's fun to see when the dice say yes, and it is fun to see when the dice just say no. Like Thomas said, Clacktruck has survived way more times than he should because he got a crit 3 times in a row. It's happened with a couple of my other fighters as well. And sometimes the dice will say no, and they're like, no, you will not hit anything. And that is life. So dice is one major aspect. The deck building, also, I'm still figuring that out, but it is fun once you figure out what your options are. And because you only get your choice of your faction card and one universal, your options are a lot more limited than any other card deck building game. But I do enjoy a good deck building game. And then there's a lot of choice on what to actually play. I had such a hard time in the beginning deciding what faction to play because there were different elves to choose from. There was Seraphon, there were dwarves, there were so many different options in terms of minis, flavor of fantasy, what playstyle you want to play. And then because our community here in Tucson is great, lots of great people, lots of friends to play with, and as always, having good people to play with is always going to be the most important part of whatever game you decide to play.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think I've played a decent number of games across my life, and the Underworlds community just worldwide, so good, really. I mean, it's just the people that you play with are cool people, and they are friendly people, and they're willing to spend time to do something other than just win a game and then say, see you later, loser. I've really enjoyed that, both locally and in a much broader perspective. It sounds like you've had some of the similar experience.
Very much so.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about, you've been playing Underworlds for, what, actively a little over a year, maybe about two now. Do you have anything you would consider like highlights of that time that you've been playing?
Yeah, so we'll just go ahead and shout out. LVO was a lot of fun, but yeah. Some specific highlights. One specific one is just, I will remember the first time I ever beat you, Thomas, because I do have to be honest, it was before you started your terrible Storm Coven longboard. It was before you decided on that as being your go-to, but it did feel like I was actually getting the game. I was actually getting this warband and figuring things out. That was a real feel-good moment for me.
We talked in the pre-show. Thomas refuses to let new players succeed and just like demoralizes and crushes all of his like new players because he's a really nice guy.
On the show before. Yeah, I won't pull my punches.
Which means you beat him for real. And I actually still have never beaten him. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So, you're not even new.
Yeah, other highlights, just I can't call out any necessarily like specific instances of when this happened, but every time Clacktrox successfully Clacktrox, I'm so proud of him.
In our local, we joke about two main jokes with Clacktrox. One is that you get Clacktroxed if he gets both attacks off in one activation. So like if I lose a Stormcast from full health in round one, I got Clacktroxed. And then the other is, even if you don't win the game against Bridget, if you do eventually manage to whittle him down and kill him, you got the moral victory at the least.
My personal goal is whenever I play the Skinks against someone is to make them fear in their hearts that Clacktroxed is coming for them.
In Mike Prime's group, they actually have one of their guys made a little Photoshop old Wild West wanted poster, and it said wanted, and you know, normally it's like wanted dead or alive, $500 to the sheriff's office or whatever. It says wanted dead Clacktroxed. There is no alive, just wanted dead, because I guess he's just a terror for them too, which is great to see, because I mean,
as he
you should be afraid of dinosaurs.
I definitely did steal that wanted poster and post it on some of Bridget's games a couple of times. All right, and then I'll cut this part out if you don't want to talk about it, but what about reminding Davey of his own button that he was wearing at LVO?
Yes. At that point, I think I was fairly certain I wasn't going to be progressing in the tournament, so Davey presented the button. I decided I wanted the button, and I was playing Starblood Stalkers and Daring Delver. I would have preferred to be the one to plunder because I would raise my exploration count. However, at that point, I had nothing that cared about exploration count in my hand, and I wanted that button, so I did. I reminded Davey to plunder.
Right. The What the Hex crew had brought with them some buttons that they had custom made that said, I remembered to plunder, and so if someone plundered in the game against them, they were handing them to their opponent. And in your game, Davey did not himself remember, right? And you reminded him even though you weren't going to, and he was
correct.
Like, oh. Yeah, I actually do that in this particular stage of the game.
Yes.
That's very funny. All right, now back to the Starblood Stalkers themselves as a warband and with their faction deck and fighter cards separate from the rest of the game. What do you think of like that warband in a vacuum?
Yeah, so we'll sort of just start with the reason why I chose Seraphon sort of in general as the faction that I would go with in Age of Sigmar or the fantasy side, just in general, even though I still have never played a game of Age of Sigmar, that's still somewhere in my future. But it came down to between the Seraphon, the Sea Elves, and the Sisters of Cain, and it really just came down to the fact that I knew I would be able to have fun painting lizards and scaly things and dinosaurs, on top of the fact that they are Mesoamerican themed lizard men time traveling through space riding dinosaurs, which is just an awesome concept. But I knew that I would be able to just have more fun painting scales as if like dragons, dinosaurs, lizards,
for sure,
than I would struggling to figure out how to properly blend or choose a skin tone. I didn't want to deal with that at the time, and I kind of still don't. So sure, I decided on the Seraphon. And so when the Starblood Stalkers came out, in a vacuum, they care about objectives. They are very picky about what universal deck to be paired with. I've tried them with Breakneck Slaughter, putting my Skinks on ice skates. Did not work the two games I played. Probably should try it a couple times, but just really didn't feel like it was gelling. Beyond that, there's a spread between being able to be melee versus ranged, but really, if you're trying to do damage, you're going to want to be in melee. Clacktroc is the main heavy hitter. If you lose him and you don't get inspired, then you really have no damage output. So games are not necessarily going to be dealt by killing the enemy fighters. And then just the fact that Kixitaka, the leader, has a special action he can take once per round to either deal one damage to someone if they're too close to a nearby objective, or to flip that objective. That's one of the only reliable pings, and also it's outside of the power step, and it's also one of the only ways to flip objectives, or rather feature tokens. Let me correct myself. It's not just objective tokens, it's feature tokens at range, which means even in this current time where we can place cover or block hexes, Casey Talkin can flip those and make that cover go away or make that blocked hex cover hex and keep it around. So I think that's a really neat niche thing to think about.
Absolutely.
I can imagine a scenario where someone's playing Force of Frost and you know they want two ice counters, ice tokens. And you say, well, that one's going to go away then because you put two down for a reason and I'm going to get rid of it. That'd be pretty mean.
Or even kill one of the little skinks and plunder them into an ice token to block off like a Claktrock charge and be like, oh, well, thanks for the cover for my Claktrock charge.
For sure. Claktrock landing spots are always prime real estate.
All right. So you talked a little bit about this in your overview of the Warband, but since you are the Starblood Stalkers expert, say I was going to pick them up and give them a spin, what Rivals deck pairings do you think work best for them in Nemesis, and why is that the way to go?
Yes. So right now, sort of top of the list is Daring Delvers. Really, like, because a lot of the things you're looking for in your objectives deck is this combination of dual objectives. Always want to have as many surges as you're allowed to have in the game. So go up to six. Then also hybrid. And that's because of a specific objective called the Great Plan. That's end phase, worth 3 points, that if you scored six objectives and at least one of those is a surge, dual and hybrid, get 3 points. You don't even have to have fighters on the field. It's one of the only objectives I've ever been able to find to run with these guys that doesn't care if I have anyone on the table. That is pretty much, if you can fit in good surges, duels, and hybrids, then it's an auto include. So the fact that Daring Delvers has not just good surges, but surges that are also hybrids and duels really helps. And those surges and duels care about standing on feature tokens or cover hexes. So you really get the benefit of that combined with the fact that everyone except for Claktrock, because Claktrock is special that way. He inspires when he makes a successful attack, which is why Claktrock goes out and Claktrocks and chomps everybody as much as he can. But everyone else will inspire after an activation, yours or your opponent's, when your Warband holds three or more objectives. So that combined with Daring Delvers caring about standing on future tokens, combined with the fact that the good objectives in their faction deck care about standing on objectives, it just goes together in such a way that if the card draw is good to mediocre, I can easily score a majority of my objectives.
So a follow-up to that, I know you played Delvers to great success at LVO, and I have only played a little bit of Starblood, so we'll be honest that I don't actually know what I'm talking about, but I always was afraid to pair them that way, despite hearing that that was a good move, because I just have perhaps retained trauma from charging 2-wound, 1-dodge fighters into enemy territory. So how do you keep your little guys safe when they are delving and exploring in not your territory, standing on tokens that your enemy knows you want to go there, right? Like, how do you work around that?
Right. Well, a couple of things. One of them is definitely my usual first activation of the game is Claktrock charges and really will pull focus. At that point, you have to decide if you're going to deal with Claktrock or ignore him, both of which have pros and cons. But also there's a couple of different ways to help with that. There's a couple things, like one of their cards is the Bulwark Celestial, which means that my guys can't be driven back. So I get to stand on the objectives. And even if we tie, then that means you can't push me off. So that's always a good thing. There's another one, Lords of Space and Time. And you'll notice that a lot of these are their faction cards. A lot of their gambits and powers I tend to keep just because they're pretty good. So Lords of Space and Time basically means I can pick someone up that's not adjacent to an enemy and then put them on an objective in your territory that's not adjacent to one of your guys. So then that means they're already a little bit safe. And then an extra thing is that three of these skinks have a special reaction called Skittish. So if I decide that keeping my guys alive is more important than keeping them next to a person who might attack them next activation, which, to be fair, this only activates after the opponent's power step, but this reaction Skittish is after an opponent's power step, push this fighter 1 hex away from an enemy fighter within 2 hexes. So there's a lot of maneuverability with these guys. Besides Claktrock, who is 3 move, goes to 4 when he's inspired, they're all pretty speedy, 4 to 5 on a majority of them. And there's a lot of move upgrades. Whenever I play, especially against elite warbands, if I don't kill one of the fighters, the big beefy fighters, whether it's like Gore Chosen, Iron Soul Condemners, Storm Coven, if I don't kill one of them the first round, second round usually begins a game of keep away, whether I've inspired or not. So that's sort of how I go about things.
Okay. So you say Daring Delvers, you can pull out your tricks and stay safe while in enemy territory. You didn't like Breakneck Slaughter. So are there any other Rivals deck pairings that you think people could try out and find success with?
So I haven't personally tried it out, but Fearsome Fortress would probably also work since it cares something about future tokens in general, at least. Paths of Prophecy, I haven't played it extensively, but I have enjoyed it. And once again, because it cares about the objectives, that will very much fit with what they care about for Inspire. Also, who doesn't want an upgrade? Because there's an upgrade in that deck that gives +1 to defense when you're standing on objective 4, 5, or 6. Who doesn't want an upgrade to make Clackdruck be 3 block or Odapodal be 4 dodge?
Well, and Clackdruck looks pretty fierce in that one too. So I played that deck a couple weeks ago. I did a Passive Prophecy Starblood in preparation for this because I said, well, I should at least play it once in the last year before we talk about it. And I scored the great plan and I won the game. So it felt good. I don't know if it would work for me every time because my opponent did me the favor of missing several important attacks. But yeah, I do feel like there is a Passive Prophecy path there. Okay, we'll roll into the next thing. So let's imagine that I, or a listener out there, is brand new to Starblood Stalkers, has never played a game with them, was going to play a game and get started with them. What are your most basic tips, the things that they must do to succeed with the Starblood Stalkers?
Yes. So first thing is there's a high learning curve. Just go into this realizing that and you'll just be okay with having to take several games to figure them out. Well, then I'll just run through sort of the order in which things get chosen is boards. I don't like taking boards with lethal hexes. I know different people will sometimes take those. Thomas specifically does like to take
certain
lethal hexes.
Certain hateful individuals on this podcast.
I mean, I also know, though, that like the CLs might like lethal hexes so that they can off spine fin if they really need to, things like that. But to your point, Mike, most of these guys are 2 wounds. I don't want to like have more lethal hexes than need be to take away one of these precious wounds on them. Especially in a ping meta, we want to keep them safe. The next thing is objectives. More often than not, going to care about being the one placing 3 objectives because we inspire when we're on 3 objectives. Having the ability to place those where we want, get a Clacktruck landing spot near where you want him to land, usually on enemy territory next to an enemy that's going to be placed there probably. Just having that control is big. I will note that the way I place objectives changes depending upon which deck I'm paired with. For Daring Delvers, I want as many objectives on the enemy's territory or no one's territory because of the exploration count. It cares about future tokens in their territory to get that up. But with others that don't care about that, so for like Paths of Prophecy and other decks that I'm testing with, if I have 3 to place, then I'll try and get more of them on my side because of the objectives that care about, one, that makes it easier to inspire, and 2, that makes some of my invade and hold objectives easier. So from there, first round, I will say in the first round, you want to be inspired as soon as possible. I very much noticed that if these guys don't get inspired by the middle of round 2, then things are probably not going well. And that may be because focus just has had to be split, but I've noticed it. So focus on 1, scoring your surges, because hopefully you have a surge at hand, and 2, getting your guys inspired. Second round, once again, is if you've not been able to kill one of those big beefy boys, if you're playing against an elite band, you're going to start playing keep away. And then third round, hopefully you've geared up to score the great plan if you weren't lucky and scored it at the end of second round. Any clarifications I can throw in there for either of you?
So it sounds like you are okay with letting them orient the boards because you want 3 objectives. You try not to pick ones with lethal hexes. The goal is to get inspired early and score a surge. Hopefully the great plan by round 2. If you can't kill a big boy, run away and then get him in the third round when you have upgrades, which I think is a pretty sound
plan. I think just this is as good a time as any to remind people to check out the Monkey's Hex blog when it comes to learning to deploy objectives. Board placement and objective placement are critically important in this game, and people learning to play this game often skip developing skill in that stage. And if you decide to develop a competitive skill, you can win or lose games in that stage of the game. So the Monkey's Hex blog does a really good job of explaining when, where, and why you're wanting to play certain objectives. All right, so let's talk about kind of on the other side of that coin. If people are going to be thinking they might face Starblood at like a tournament or even just in their local meta, what do you think are good tactics to take against the Starblood Stalkers? What has been, you know, difficult for you to try to face and overcome? And what causes you some stress to see across the table?
Certainly. So I think number one, just going to say, expect that high learning curve to hit you too. It goes for both players. They have a high learning curve. But I'm going to say, one, it is always hurtful to see someone on the other side that can one-shot Claktroc. It's just always hurtful, and it's so rude, but they exist out there. So definitely those, I won't necessarily say that they've been particularly difficult, but Elite Warbands will tend to, because they hit hard and are beefy, if I lose Claktroc, if I lose other damage dealers, and that quickly makes it less of a me trying to score points. And like I said before, a keep away game to try and brick you from killing my guys as hard as possible, and with me scoring being suddenly secondary to things.
Right. Much more denial in Starblood than in most other meta warbands.
For sure. So yeah, going from there, going to say when placing fighters, we've said it, Claktroc's going to Claktroc, so be careful who you're going to leave in Claktroc range. If your leader can get Claktroc, your leader will get Claktroc. So expect that if your leader's within Claktroc range. And then sort of just going from there, you're going to hear Claktroc a lot. You have a hard choice to make. Do you deal with Claktroc? And you could be lucky and take out Claktroc in 1 to 2 activations, but he has also survived being focused on for 2 whole rounds. So you have to decide if you need to deal with Claktroc and get that moral victory, even though it will let the skinks run around and do what they want to do. So that's the con. Pro, Claktroc is out. You have the moral victory. You did it. Con, the skinks have scored me a lot of points by then.
He's also quite easy to inspire, and 2 block is no joke.
Yeah, my experience has been he usually turn one charges me, and if that attack hits, I will never look at him again. And he's in the way of me getting to the skinks, because I've learned the hard way that you will charge him, fail, and then he will destroy you for even.
And he gets 2 tries to inspire on that first activation. And like, sure, Powerful Jaws is on 1 fury, but like that dice still has a crit on it.
Yeah, no, definitely. And bonus, because it's a reaction, it is helpful to scoring one of your objectives, which is make 2 reactions in the same phase. So it just built in one of those reactions that I want to make across the phase if I have that in my hand. So yeah, but the other option, ignoring Claktroc. So pro, the skinks will have to focus on the keep away game more, but might have a con in itself if you don't want them to keep skittishing away. If you want them to not move away from you as much, then you'll have to be careful how hard you push the skinks player into the keep away game. Con is that Claktroc will still be there and will chomp whenever he has the option. If you take out skinks and Claktroc's charged out and everyone else is charged out and you're next to Claktroc, then he gets to attack again. So that's fun for Claktroc. And then other things is just because they care about objectives, if they're standing on objectives and that's where they want to be, so you're going to want to drive them off those objectives whenever you have the opportunity, unless you personally have a good reason to not, whether or not it's because you didn't charge and you don't want to have to charge and you want to have the opportunity to keep attacking them, or any other reason. And then keep in mind the great plan. If your point lead is less than or equal to 3 points, it will swing their way probably if they have the opportunity to be able to get there. And then lastly, anything in your hand, if you care about having no enemies in your territory, that will be difficult because their objective deck inherently wants them to invade.
Okay, let's take a bit of a lightning round. This question is not in the show notes, so you're not ready for it. You have found yourself invited to the World Championships of Warhammer. You have brought the Starblood Stalkers. Of course, you are dominating. You have just destroyed everybody. You are in the finals. You win this game, you are world champion. You look across the table and the warband that you see gives you either great hope or great fear. What warband do you have the most confidence facing? And what warband are you the most afraid of?
Let's see. Probably most confidence would be probably one of the warbands with recursion, whether that's Sepulchral Guard or Spike Claws or Exiled Dead. If you give Claktrok fodder, he will take it. That is really an easy way for Claktrok to really ramp you up points, especially if they decide to recur them right in front of Claktrok. I would say the scariest is honestly probably going to be a tie between Hexbanes, Kanans, and Headsmen, because they all really easily will one-shot Claktrok. There's definitely others out there, but I don't have as much experience against them. I don't necessarily know in my heart to be afraid of them, but I would say definitely Kanans, definitely Headsmans, and then just because my first time ever playing against Hexbanes was at LVO, that was rough.
That's a tough one. I'm scared of all three of those, no matter what warband I'm playing, so yeah, I can see that being true. Okay, so let's roll on to my next question. So you've been playing Starblood Stalkers for some time. Like you said, you've been working on cooking up a couple experiments. Do you plan to stick with them for the foreseeable future, or is there a new warband that's caught your eye? And then follow up to that is, Daring Delvers is going to rotate in 6 to 10 months. What pairing are you going to lean on at that point?
Yeah, so I definitely plan to keep playing them as long as there is a pairing that will support them. So on that, probably will start leaning a lot more heavily on Passive Prophecy. I'm testing out Malevolent Masks. I'm hopeful, though we'll have to see how that works out.
Join the dark side.
Yeah.
Masks are so cool. I don't know if they work with this warband, but I will mask anybody.
Yeah, no, definitely. Point. And really looking at them, because once again, any universal pairing I'm looking at is going to be because there's something in there that cares about me standing on either an objective or a feature token, probably. So Masks has a couple of those. So I'm really want to test it out some more. I was hopeful for Force of Frost, but then I realized it had no duels. So that means I would either have to include one of the terrible duels or at least less ideal duels that comes from the faction deck for the Skinks, for the Seraphon, or I would have to figure out a different end phase three-pointer than the Great Plan, which would definitely be an adjustment. And then from there, we'll have to see what Rhyme Locked Relics does. But most promising, but I haven't had the chance to test it out yet, is Void Curse Thralls. And flavor-wise, I would love that to work because the Void Curse is coming from a Realm Shaper engine. But yeah, besides that, I do want to not just be only Skinks, so probably will play a little bit more Gnarl Spirit, like I had mentioned before, but also decided that I want to paint up and play my Ephilims, so we'll see how that goes. And at least some new ones, Dagox and Zondaras, seem like they would be new fun playstyles, so I hope to have a chance for that. And then lastly, I'm always hoping for a new Seraphon band, so if they announce that will automatically be the next thing I try.
I mean, I feel like they're overdue, right? It's been how long, and they've only had one. So if you get those and I get Beastmen, I think we're both going to be great.
I couldn't believe we didn't get new Seraphon in Weird Hollow and new Sylvaneth in Gnarlwood. I would have gambled on both of those. All right, and our final question is a little bit outside of Underworlds specifically, but more generically for any game system. What do you think are the key steps that a community can take to build a healthy and welcoming space to bring new players into?
Yeah, so I think there's probably a couple aspects, and I'll keep it only to one or two. But I think firstly is, if you're in the position of leading the community or even just being in the orbit of being core of community, we'll say, try to always keep a feel out for what the vibe is. If you keep seeing new players show up, but then they never show up again, make certain that the people who are teaching are there and willing to teach and are at least able to explain the rules enough that they're able to get a feel for things. I always tell new players that it took me personally 3 games for the rules to even start to gel. So if it seems like a lot right now, that's okay. Let's just bear with it. I always offer to play open hand so they can sort of see my thought process. And yeah, always just trying to make certain that the vibe of everyone is good. That if for some reason people are getting tilted or testy, that we're able to figure out what that is and hopefully, you know, mitigate that for the future. And then that will help new players feel welcome. They don't want to get tilted. They don't want to get tilted at. And yeah, at the end of the day, it's a game and we're there to have fun. So yeah, I think that's probably a couple of the most important things.
For sure. All right. That will conclude our making a statement. So we will now move into an uncovered secrets segment. Usually in this segment, what we'll do is we'll pick a card that we think is maybe overlooked or that people don't fully get all the nuance of, or for some reason we think doesn't get quite the praise or interest that it might deserve. Usually, I would pick the card and the other hosts would debate it. But as we have invited someone on to tell us about their favorite warband and playstyles and deck builds, we thought we would offer Bridget, would you like to choose a card to spring on us and have us debate the merit of?
I would love to. So I was really debating whether or not I would choose Tepic's Mystery, but that's so obviously a trash card. I don't know how anyone could spin that to be good. So I'm going to choose Invisible Hunter. The text of this, we'll start with the flavor text. It was right here. I saw it move. It cannot have gone far, said by Glissette. So Invisible Hunter says, remove a friendly Oddapodl from the battlefield. That fighter is not out of action. This card persists until the end of the round. When this card no longer persists, place that fighter in any empty hex not adjacent to any enemy fighters. You cannot play this card in round 3.
All right. Very interesting card. And I do love the flavor text. And in the art, she's just looking at like a different real actual lizard while Oddapodl is like preying on her from a branch behind her. So what's your like elevator pitch for why we should give this card a second chance if we had dismissed it originally?
Yeah, so I'll admit I don't run it in most of my Nemesis pairings, but it is definitely that 11th choice sitting there. And I love it because it just adds to the fact that Oddapodl is going to be hard to kill. He starts 2 dodge, he becomes 3 dodge when he inspires, and is always going to be trying to shoot you from farther away. So just to be able to say, actually, he is maybe in imminent danger of being attacked, or you just don't want him on the field right now for one reason or another. Maybe you don't want him to be Void Cursed or Breakneck Slaughtered or something else, but to just say he is in the ether. You don't get a point for him being off the battlefield, and he gets to come back wherever I want. Not adjacent to you. So it'd be a really good setup for the next round sometime during the first 2 rounds. So yes, he's not present for scoring objectives in the end phase, but really good to deny points and set things up.
Right. Exactly. That last part is critical. Like, he isn't there for scoring is more of a denial thing. Like, it hurts your opponent way more than it hurts you, right? There are so many situations where like you'll have a surge in your hand that says, kill so-and-so fighter. And if that fighter just disappears, you know, whether it be like kill an enemy fighter on an objective or kill an enemy fighter, I don't know, that has Void Curse or whatever other keyword we've applied to them. Not a good situation if Oddapodl is Void Cursed, but if he can just disappear and no longer be a liability. I think another like huge value here is if he is Void Cursed and the rest of your fighters are charged out and Oddapodl is the only one you can activate and you can just blink him out of existence and now your Clackshock gets to Clackshock all of a sudden, that's a huge thing that your opponent will not have been preparing for, right?
More opportunities for Clackshock.
Everything is a Clackshock card if you want it to be.
That's what this is all about. So my take on this card, I will give you some context. When Starblood Stalkers came out, I thought I really liked Jurassic Park. I wore dinosaur pajamas to school instead of just to bed when I was a kid. Like, I thought, I'm going to give these guys a go, right? And so I played with them, not a ton, but a couple of games back in Diachasm when they came out. And I did include this card at the time because I thought, you know, how cool is this that you can just teleport over a couple of times? And this is so long ago, I don't remember all the details, but I drew it in round 3, so I can't use it. Or Oddapodl has already died, and so this isn't useful. Or I actually want him here because I want to make his attack or something like that. It never felt like the right time when I did have it. But I can see when it is the right time. It is just such a great card, which is why I included it, because you say, okay, I am pretty sure you're trying to score, have two fighters adjacent to one of mine, and I'm just going to say, no, I'm not here anymore. Or you have all your fighters within some distance, or nobody's in my territory, or whatever thing you're trying to aim for. If I know what your general objective is, and I can block that with this card. And I think at the time I had struggled with that because I was not as experienced in the game, but also we were all playing championship back then. And so there were so many more options for what you thought your opponent might try and score.
Right.
And now that we are in a rivals nemesis world where you can have much more confidence that, yeah, they're probably going for that card and I can stop it by just taking Onopodal off the board and now they can't score it. That, I think, having the confidence of like more reliably being able to guess what your opponent is playing means that this has a lot more utility than it used to. And so, I mean, I would say for the purpose of an uncovered secret, yeah, this is you've uncovered gold. Like, I think there are definitely ways this card can brick, right? Like I talked about before, you draw it at the wrong time, Onopodal's not there, or you want him still where he's at. But when it works, this can win you a game. This can shut down a big three glory score from them. It can make it so that they're not able to charge out anymore because he was the only target and now he's gone. Like, there's a lot of stuff you can do that's really nasty to somebody. And so I think actually, yeah, this is a good card that I'm sure a lot of people overlooked because back then it was hard to use, but I think it's better now than it was.
Yeah, you said my favorite word there is utility. The ceiling on this card is insane. Sure, the floor on it is really high. Like, there are a lot of situations, like you said, where this card is bricked or just not optimal. But if you're planning for it, like you said, dangling Onopodal so that they're trying to charge out into him and then he just disappears, there's so much denial potential. And we talked before about how denial is actually kind of a huge part of your game plan if you're playing Starblood. I think I actually rate this card relatively highly just for the potential that it poses. I think one huge aspect of it that doesn't seem as big at a glance, at least the first time I read it, is that he comes back in any empty hex not adjacent to an enemy fighter. A lot of these types of cards are like, pick a starting hex in your territory or something like that, or they'll be more restrictive. Even if it was like, some of these types of cards are teleport to an edge hex. Like, this can be an objective. It could be a cover token. It can be, you know, exactly three spaces away from like the person you absolutely need to hit with his dart in the first activation of the following round. Like, just the fact that his dart attack is also really gnarly. So setting that up in the most advantageous way, regardless of all those other great things that we talked about, I think is really powerful. So as much as, like I said, the floor on this card is a little scary, there's a lot of ways to brick it. I think the ceiling on this card is so good that I kind of really like it now that we've talked about it.
You know, you begin the round with him in that spot. And so if you have a card that requires two fighters to be doing something and you can say one of them's already there and that can be
right in
the far corner of their field or the far corner of yours or dead in the center on an objective or whatever, like you pick any empty hex so long as it's not adjacent to an enemy fighter. And depending on the warband you're playing, and as Bridget explained, we're most scared of the elite ones. They have fewer fighters, which means you have more landing spots right for this card. So it becomes better the more dangerous your opponent is. And so, I mean, that's, to me, that's a plus. This is a good card.
One really niche thing that I like is that it persists for a very long time. And so specifically in Toxic Terrors, I really like the card Deluge of Toxins. And I really like finding weird ways to score it. And this card...
You'll have a persistent gambit for the entire round. And so then you just need to get
two others as you want.
Got it. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think it sounds like we both have the verdict of good card, good pick. And yeah, I think this would count as an uncovered secret because it's not... I haven't seen this card in a long time, but people should maybe not sleep on it.
And at the very least, certainly very interesting.
Love to hear it. Like I said, I don't recently had it in any of my decks, but I always play it whenever I have the opportunity when I'm playing them rivals. So it's up there.
How about, did we sway you on it any? Did we?
Yeah, you said it was number 11. Has it made its way up to number 10? Like, are you?
I mean, it's definitely, especially for... Probably won't make it into my current Daring Delvers build, but it definitely will rate a second look for my Passive Prophecy build that's still in the works, Voidcrest Thralls, and any of the other combinations I'm looking at. Definitely going to have to consider that. And yeah, definitely the denial part, it's always there.
So here's a question. When it says at the end of the round, I should know this. At what point of... So you finished the action, you finished all the scoring... Have you drawn your new cards so you know, ooh, I'm holding a Passive Prophecy stand on 3. Oh, well, objective 3 is open, so there we go. I dropped him on it. Like, do you know what you're holding for next round before you place him?
Yes.
Okay, because in that case, this is tremendous for Passive Prophecy and possibly for masks too. If he has a mask and you could put him on an odd or an even and just like make that happen. Exactly. Yeah, I think this, in those decks, actually, there's a lot of ways you can play with this.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that until you just said that. Especially in Passive Prophecy, I really like this card a lot more now. Being able to see what you're going to score before you place him, that's pretty good. All right, with that, let's move into our final segment for today's episode is going to be another having a good time. Other Mike, would you like to tell us what we do when we have a good time and what today's topic is?
So in having a good time, we generally pick a non-gameplay thing to talk about. And something that excites us about the game is the lore behind it, the characters, the general theme and flavor. So we talk about something that's just not going to affect your gameplay at all. It will not make you a better player, but it may make you love the game more like we do. And so we pose a silly question and then we talk about our silly answers to it and we have a good time. So today, the question that I've got for us is, the Chaos God's baleful gaze has turned to the underworlds. And wouldn't you know it, a new position for Demon Prince has opened up. Which fighter does each god promote for their exemplary service and devotion? So we'll go through the gods one at a time, and we'll start with the god Khorne. And Thomas, who do you think Khorne is going to pick from the batch of Underworld's fighters to be elevated to the status of Demon Prince?
So I actually was really torn on Khorne specifically, because I feel like just kind of murdering stuff is pretty intrinsic to Underworlds and its lore as a whole. So I felt like there were quite a few fighters that fit this one in a lot of just pretty obvious ways. In a fairly straightforward way, I think my final choice is going to be Anias Curseborn. He is a vampire. Blood's a huge running plot line through his life. Many of his cards, arts and flavor text show him like really giving into the vampiric thirst and really just letting the blood flow. Especially, I think if Khorne were, you know, not satisfied with any of his already like representative fighters, like the Khorne themed warbands, I think Anias is a pretty good candidate for promotion.
He's nice and bloody. I don't know if Nagash is gonna like take too kindly to that. But then again, that guy doesn't like anyone, so what's the point of making him mad?
And it's like a running joke in AOS lore at this point that people just take stuff from Nagash and he doesn't really get to do anything about it. The entire Anvils of the Heldenhammer, they're not chapters.
Straight stolen war host. But they're just straight stolen from him. Like they said, oh yeah, you know, you're supposed to have these dudes, but they're mine now.
Yep.
So rude.
All right, Bridget. So Khorne is considering his options. Anias Curseborn is on the short list, but he's not done looking around for other options yet. Who do you think he should elevate to demonhood?
So mine is in the same region, but I'm going to preface this with saying in our meta, Thomas, just to explain this, is that we've always joked whenever a Gore Chosen player plays against a Crimson Court player that this is blood for the blood god all around. Yes. Both sides just want more blood. So I think Khorne would just lock the Crimson Court and Gore Chosen in a room and last one standing.
So then next question, who's the last one standing? So I think I'm going Gorath, personally.
I mean, it would probably depend upon the day, but, you know, I don't know who the last would be standing, and the reason that's why he's locking them in a room.
You gotta find out, yeah.
You gotta find out.
What was the Joker from one of the Batmans that was like, he took over the mob and he like broke a pool cue in half and threw a spike down and was like, whoever survives, he's gonna be like, I forget exactly the context, but that's what that reminds me of. Okay, so for my entry on Khorne, and the last one on the list for this, Khorne is looking around at his options, and you know, you got to respect the homegrown talent, right? Your farm system for your baseball team, it's important you look at your minor leagues. You can't always just be doing trades with other major organizations. You do eventually want to have a homegrown hero. And Khorne does have a fair number of homegrown heroes to choose from, and the one that I am picking is Magor Redhand. So we're going to start. He's got the name.
It's a good one.
The name Red is already in his name, right? Khorne loves red. He loves red hands. And so that's already taken care of. He already has a big old demon mouth in his stomach.
Yeah, he is like half demon.
He's halfway there. He's sort of half demon. This mouth in his belly can bite dudes. He has a demon bound to his axe. So he's already in possession of another one there. And then he's made friends with the demon dog. So he's like, he's put in the legwork. The man's got a resume. He's got years of dedicated service. I don't know if Khorne really cares about merit in that way, but I feel like he's made a compelling case for promotion and would do well in the role. So I'm going to say Magor Redhand should be Khorne's choice.
And I would say Korn definitely does have like a merit-based system in effect. It's just that the argument for merit is basically just a pile of skulls.
I mean, but he's holding two of them and he has several more on his base. He's showing off the work he's done. I think he's earned it.
Yeah, so I think in the HR structure of how many points he has to earn to promote, I think he's got quite a few skulls on that ladder already.
He's the internal hire that should be promoted.
Yeah, correct. But we'll see if that's the mood that Korn CEO is in today. All right, we'll move on to our next god. I've got Nurgle on the list and I will open with this one. Nurgle doesn't have as many themed fighters to choose from as Korn does, so he may have to look afield a little more. But the thing about Nurgle is that he is a grandfather who loves to tend his garden. And some of those gardens have great growths, and he loves to observe those growths. And, you know, when you are tending your garden, the grass is always greener on the other side, but I don't think he's the kind of guy to stray and pick from somewhere else. I think he does like what he's got, and you can't tell me that the grandfather hasn't noticed Sepsimus working that slug butt all over the Dire Chasm. It's just so good. He's such a cool looking fighter. He's got some mutations and growths and whatever. He, to me, just says this is what the best version of Nurgle is. And so I would say basically ignore all the plague rats, ignore all of the like chaos undivided, ignore all the other people. Like, I want to say that Sepsimus is the coolest of all of the Nurgle fighters, and if anyone is going to become a demon, it should be him. And unless you guys have any protests about that, you can tell me otherwise. Thomas, who do you think Nurgle should pick?
So I have at the top of my list for Nurgle right now is Slink Skittershank. I actually tossed up a few like poisoners in this one, and I think that Slink being able to deliver his weeping blades into people and deliver what certainly Grandfather Nurgle would consider to be a gift to those on the receiving end, I think that Slink is probably one of the most prolific poisoners that we have in the Underworlds, short of like Spinefin.
Spinefin is a Nurgle god. Demon would be
Spinefin is the most efficient poisoner in the game, and it drives me insane.
And he never goes away. Like, one of Nurgle's things is that they're here forever, right? You can't stop them, and Spinefin will always be there. So I think actually is
honorable mention
sneaker Spinefin. Pick right there for sure. All right, Bridget, who do you think Nurgle has taken to town?
Well, last and certainly least, until chosen by Nurgle, I would say Skritter. That little worthless rat who does his best and is going to spread the plague. You might squish him, but another rat will take his place and become Skritter. I think you got to go with the plague rat.
And I mean, Nurgle's the kind of guy who would be nice enough to actually be willing to look all that way down the ladder and picks the smallest of his friends. It's a good choice. If we're ready, we can move on to Tzeentch. And Bridget, I'll let you roll right into that. Who do you think Tzeentch should pick for elevation?
So really debated on myself on whether or not it should be one of the leaders of the warbands that actually have the word plan in one of their like cards, but I'm going to make some people in our meta happy and say Kirk from Spikeclaws. Be almost trusted. Like, he's got to have a 100-step plan on how to become trusted and take leadership. It's got to be so complicated, and that's why he's still almost trusted, and he's going to get there.
That's a good pick, actually. Kirk does have, like, some sneaky deep cut plans that he will deny thoroughly.
And they've got to be complicated, too. Otherwise, why are they always failing?
Yeah, so it says Skritch.
They're not failing, they just haven't succeeded yet.
Part of why Skritch trusts or almost trusts Kirk is because he seems like he's too dumb to take the reins, you know, and backstab him. Like, he's so dumb he's loyal to me, and I couldn't trust him if he was smarter. But that's what a smart one would want you to think, right?
Right.
Is he just playing dumb until his time has come? I think that's actually a pretty good option there. So in Tzeentch, I had the same kind of idea. I thought, who is the biggest schemer? Who's the biggest plotter? And it's really hard to argue against Ephelim from like the merit perspective, you know, like clearly they have done a great job. They used to work for a Silver Tower person. They have collected all these demons. They have absolutely destroyed people in the Underworlds for a long time. But I don't think Tzeentch is the merit-based type because...
Certainly not.
Much like Skritch and Kirk, like, do you really want someone that competent, that close to you? And I think the answer is no. So Tzeentch is going to pass over Ephelim for doing too good of a job. It's going to pass over Vortimus for doing too bad of a job, because that guy was in the Night Vault for a very long time, supposedly looking for this mirror that he never found, that he would turn on, that I doubt he knows how to do. And then we read the short story that he's wandered off into Beastgrave. Like, that's not where you're supposed to be, man. Like, have you forgotten the mission? So basically written off the list. And those are our two Tzeentch leaders. That's not going anywhere. So I had to look elsewhere. And we know that they need to be smart. We know that they need to be able to do some magic. We know that they can't be too threatening to Tzeentch. And so I think looking at that, the winner has got to be Thedra Skullscryer. She's got some magic. She's got some witchery. She's got some future seeing. She's not really that dangerous, but she can still hold her own. And she definitely is the crafty one of the Chaos bunch. So I would say, seeing as the two Tzeentch warbands have absolutely failed in their ability to adequately impress Tzeentch without being too threatening, Thedra is going to be the elevated one. And then let's move on to Thomas. Who do you think it'll be?
So I did decide to go with someone that has a great plan, and I went with Kisitaka the Diviner. He can read the runes, he can see some amount of the future, he understands, or at least can attempt to parse in some way the great plan. And I think that him doing so successfully for so long has definitely caught the attention of Tzeentch.
Okay, so we will then move on to Slaanesh, our final Chaos God. Thomas, let me know who you think Slaanesh is going
to
choose.
So I decided to go with Grizel of the Arenae, who was also at the top of my list for Khorne, to be fair, but I decided that the Arenae's focus is like equal parts drawing blood and also showboating. And I think as much as the blood aspect really gets Khorne's attention, blood and showboating at the same time, like delivering pain in a spectacular display and putting on a performance, is very Slaanesh-y.
And Slaanesh elevating one of the Daughters of Cain would make them would very so upset. Funny. They would be really upset about it. I think that would actually add extra flavor here. Laughing at them as they're like, no, not this, anything. Okay, it's a pretty good choice. All right, Bridget, who is Slaanesh taking?
Yeah, so I'll also say Grizel was sort of my second choice for Khorne, but for Slaanesh, I think in my heart, I really feel like it's just as whichever goblin is the highest whenever Slaanesh is making their choice, because otherwise I have a second choice, but my honorable mention would be Black Powder, because he's a pirate, he's got swag, and he's gonna...
He's got so much swag. He has so much swag.
He's going to break your upgrades, and that's gonna hurt, but if it's overindulgence, it's gonna be the goblins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also had Grincrack and Snorbo as my honorable mentions for Slaanesh, just because of their like drug dealing racket.
I've got it on good authority that that mushroom potion from the Zarbags has got something good in it. So I forget his name now, but the guy with the big old ball and chain, like that guy's probably the highest.
Yeah, and just calling back to, I think it was Grincrack who was selling the mushroom coins.
Like, the mushroom tether coin. Yeah. Slaanesh loves scams, I'm sure. Okay, so when I was looking at the Slaanesh fighters, I thought, okay, we have again a Slaanesh warband or two. One of them is made of mortals who can be elevated to demons, and it's kind of hard to argue against Thassaluk the Gifted, but he's already had some gifts, right? And like, we got to jealously hoard these, so we're moving on. We're not giving that out. Shond has some really good looking thighs, so that has got to be appealing, but you can't have anyone show you up, so I don't think Slaanesh is going to take Shond either. And then I thought, probably actually the best pick is going to be Manok de Cunit, and the reason for this, the man's got style, he's got fashion, he wears a bird cage on his head with his bird pet, he's the one in the cage, look at that, I'm making a statement. He's got sadistic control over his homeboys, he definitely is cruel, and definitely has like sinister just vindictiveness, which is what Slaanesh is about. And then he shows off. He loves boasting. All of his card quotes are like telling his like boys, like, that's why you follow me. And basically he thinks he's hot stuff and he wants you to know that too. And there's nothing Slaanesh loves more than a boastful braggart who can back it up. And so I would say Manok de Cunit is who is getting elevated by Slaanesh. Does anyone have any honorable mentions for any of the gods that we've missed?
I have, as an honorable mention for Khorne, I have the wielder of the blade stealing another of Nagash's servants, just because of the sheer amount of decapitated skulls he has created. Mm-hmm. And then quickly for Nurgle, we know that Nurgle loves life as much as disease and decay. And in the 40K lore, Nurgle has like abducted the elven god of like life and growth. And so I think he may turn his gaze like longingly toward Ilthari just to kind of fill that same role in the mortal realms.
In the AOS lore, I think he had captured the goddess of life, the one who rides on the whole beetle thing.
He did Lariel? I think he tried to, and failed to. Yeah. She put herself in a coma to like heal up from the damage he had done to her, if I remember correctly. Someone, probably George, will text me and
that's wrong.
The right answer.
Yeah, so he's been chasing after her, and if you can't get her, at least you can go for her sister or something. Maybe that's the move.
Right, yeah.
All right. Well, I think that just about wraps up having a good time. So thank you for having a good time with me. And listeners, if you disagree or have your own nominees, let us know at underworldsunderground@gmail.com. And we will see if we can't find the best possible demon princes for our four gods.
All right. And then if listeners wanted to contact you or were looking for a game or had any questions, Bridget, how would you like them to reach you?
Yeah. So I am Cinder, C-I-N-D-R. No E in there, on the Vassal Discord. Otherwise, bother these guys and they'll be able to reach me.
Yeah, we'll screen her calls for her. We're already doing it for Cabanias too. So, and then, of course, always make sure to check out the spentglory.com website, and living there now is also all of the Sleekspole content. Email us if you have any ideas for better answers for our having a good time, or any questions, ideas, or especially corrections. I love those. but otherwise, this was Underworlds Underground coming to you from the rime-frosted caverns of the Death Gorge.
Working that slug butt all over the dire chasm.